Do you have a money question on your mind? Well, do we have a deal for you during this edition of On Your Money? Kevin McKinley is here with an answer to that question, maybe, at 1-800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. Or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. Good morning. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's 8 minutes past 8 o'clock on this Tuesday, March the 29th. And Kevin went through the mailbag and pulled out some outstanding questions, but there's still room for you as well. Kevin McKinley, certified financial planner and managing member of McKinley Money LLC, joins us from our studios in Eau Claire. Good morning, Kevin.
Good morning, Joy.
I know we are devoting most of this hour to questions and comments from listeners. I have one to start us off, though. Why is it that last week I had to bring my dog into the vet for a regular checkup, and that cost me $500, and the very next day my husband's check engine light went on, and that cost us $500?
Was this an internal problem your husband was having with his check engine light?
On his CRV.
His diet? And how do I get that?
Yeah, actually? This little
because
thing
my
on his forehead.
Has been running a little low lately, and it's been idling a little rough in my personal engine. And I'd like to, I think it should be looked at, quite frankly, and I want to know where to
take
it.
I think we all should have a check engine light. That would be good. But you know what I mean. Why is it that big bills, unexpected big bills come at once?
Whenever I try to gauge an individual or a family's financial situation or security, one of the first questions and most important questions that I ask is, what do you spend every month? And everyone struggles with that issue, even people who track this stuff and project it out on Excel spreadsheets for, you know, the year 2025. They always say, well, you know, we spend $4,000 a month, but there are always these odd $500 expenses that in and of themselves don't come up more than once every 3 years, but every single month there's always some $500 mm-hmm. expense that you don't really care to pay. You know, you have to. There's no way around it. So I just hope that you don't have to choose between your husband's check engine light and your pet.
That's true. The CRV would be at the junkyard, let me tell you. But good thing that we also had had a tax return recently, so that helped out. But there are a lot of people are asking you about how we're doing financially as a whole. How are we doing?
Well, people really do need to know these things, in part because it gives them a sense of what's going on in the rest of the world and the economy, and gives them some opportunity to plan, but also to know that you just get a chance to say, is it me, or is it, does everyone feel like this? Does everyone feel that there is, you know, things are less stable right now and they might not be, you know, plunging into the abyss, but it still just doesn't seem to be getting a whole lot better. Let's start with the good news first. According to the Federal Reserve, household net worth, this is Americans' household, their net worth was up about 4%. At the end of the last quarter, in that previous quarter. That's about $56 trillion, $56 trillion of household net worth in America. That works out to about $500,000 or so per household, and it is home equity, stocks, savings, certificates of deposit. Part of that has been helped, of course, by rising assets, but also some of that has been affected by the fact that Americans' debt has generally fallen back somewhat as well.
Well, that sounds like good news so far.
It should be, but it's not as good for those in the middle. The vast majority of the people are not doing any better than they once were, at least on a statistical basis, especially compared to 2 or 3 years ago. The increased wealth, much of it has become from a rising stock market, which most Americans don't directly benefit from, that they don't have a large portion of their worth in stocks or stock mutual funds. There are much less exciting gains to be seen in housing, which is where the middle class has a lot of their wealth and their noticeable wealth in net worth. As a matter of fact, housing prices have been flat now for several years, depending on whom you ask. About 66 million Americans households have a house that they own of the 110 million or so out there. And so that's the real thing that they concentrate on when they're deciding if they can spend money or so. They can't cash in their home equity like they once were able to. They can't sell their house in many cases because they're so far underwater. So it generally leads to people pulling their savings in and reining in what they're doing with their cash.
What about this falling debt you mentioned? Is that a positive sign?
It would seem to be, because in quantity, the amount of debt that Americans have out there is falling. But once you examine the numbers, in reality, it's not quite so positive. Much of the debt reduction has come from debts being written off, like mortgage foreclosures, short sales that the banks have agreed to, credit card abatements that people have said, look, I owe the credit card company $15,000. I'll give them $10,000 and see if they accept it, and then I can write it off whatsoever. In fact, the charge-offs are greater over the last 3 years than the total change in debt. So it means that more people are writing off debt than are paying off the debt. The increases that we've seen have been in consumer loans and student loans, which the consumer loans are good for the economy if it means that credit is being freed up and people feel more comfortable spending money. It's bad if it means that that's their only source of being able to buy things that they really need. Student loans have also risen quite a bit. Again, that's good news if it means that we're going to have a smarter, more educated workforce coming out of schools in the next few years. It's bad if it means that families are doing this as the last-ditch effort to try to pay for college. It also means that people are borrowing money to bid up, which ends up bidding up the price of going to college as well over the people who can just pay cash for it. We'll wait and see what happens with the after effects, but all of this debt outstanding means there's going to be more pressure on those people to try to pay it off in a few years.
Kevin, please tell me that you see a cure for this economic stagnation.
I do. Mm-hmm. I have a guaranteed cure for it.
Yay.
It's called time.
Okay. Boom.
Lots and lots of time. We need to work through this housing overabundance that we have. We have roughly anywhere from 6 to 10 million houses that we really don't need right now from an economic standpoint that need to be worked through, and they need to be sold at prices that represent the true market value. The good news, though, is that as boomers age and retire, they will leave their jobs and younger workers will take over. And the younger workers will generally take over for a lower pay than the boomers left at. The younger workers are going to tax the healthcare system less than the older workers were doing it. When the younger workers get jobs, they form households and they buy homes and start paying taxes into Social Security and Medicare and income taxes and property taxes. But it is going to take a long time. We're talking years, not months, for this problem to fix itself.
Kevin McKinley is the managing member of McKinley Money, LLC, a registered investment advisor with offices in Eau Claire and Madison. Kevin does not intend to provide personalized investment advice through this broadcast and does not represent that the securities or services discussed are suitable for any investor. Investors should consult with their financial advisors prior to making any investment decisions. If you have a question for Kevin, our lines are full now, but there should be one open soon at 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. Lynn in Oshkosh is with us. Hello, Lynn.
Hi.
Lynn, are you there?
Yeah. Oh, I'm sorry.
You're on the air. Go ahead.
Hi. I have two questions, actually. One is, when they say that you are to save 6 to 8 months worth of emergency fund, is that considered money in your savings account or in stocks? And also, where is the best place to put that money to save it?
Are those your two questions?
Yeah, that's it.
Okay. I'm going to give you a 1A and 1B question.
Okay.
Yeah, that's fair enough. 6 to 8 months, usually what people use that is to say if you lose your job or you lose your income, you need to have that savings set aside so that you can support yourself while you look for another job. There is a strange thing going on right now in that it takes much longer than it used to find a job, and especially the higher up that you go on the pay or prestige or whatever you want to call it, the longer it usually takes. So I would say that people should actually have hopefully a year's worth of liquid savings that they can get at, because most middle class and management jobs take that long to replace if they can do it. That's the bad news. The good news is that money can come from several different places. It can, of course, come from savings. It can also come from Roth IRAs. If you've saved money in a Roth IRA, you know that you can pull the contributions back out whenever you want. We are going to talk about that in a little bit. And also, in a real tight pinch, it can come from home equity. And that's why people should establish a home equity line of credit so that they can draw from that, again, if they need the money without having to apply for it when they need it. Because by definition, when they need it, they're not going to be able to borrow against it if they have to apply at that time. So you should get a home equity line of credit. But I would definitely have you have at least the 6 months figure that you mentioned, Lynn, was a good one. That I'd like to see just in short-term CDs and savings that you can get at when you want. And then the next 6 months, I'm more comfortable using those expenses, again, for Roth IRAs or for home equity line of credit.
We'll see if there's a 1C question. Lynn?
I'm sorry, what?
Go ahead. Do you have a follow-up?
No, that's wonderful. That always puzzled me as far as where it actually should be sitting and accumulating interest. So, and as far as home equity line of credit, that we can should go apply for right now.
Yes. Get one now. Get one for as much as the bank is willing to lend you. When they say to you, well, there's going to be a $200 fee to appraise your home, say, thank you very much. Here's my $200. When they say there's going to be a $100 annual fee to keep it open, say, here's the $100. Let me know when you need it again, because it's very difficult to get when you need it. So if you have it and don't need it, you're in great shape. But if you need it and don't have it, you're really going to be in a tough situation.
Thank you very much, Lynn. Good luck. Maria in New Berlin is with us now. Hi, Maria.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call.
Good morning.
Well, I had a question for your guest. I'm a 24-year-old college graduate, and I'm about to start a graduate program this summer. It's at a private university, and so all in all, when it's all said and done, I'll be about $80,000 in debt. And I know the rule that you don't take out more money in student loans than you should in your first year of working, and so my starting salary will be a little bit less than $80,000. But I'm wondering, I have about $3,000 in savings. How much of that can I draw from to start paying off the interest on those student loans? I'm kind of worried about, you know, being slammed with debt as soon as I graduate, especially with those interest payments that can accrue while I'm at school. But I don't want to completely deplete that savings account. I just wanted to know where that balance point is.
Well, let's back up here for a second, Maria. If you don't mind me asking, what are you going to study in your graduate school program?
I'm a nurse practitioner.
Nurse practitioner, okay. And that pays $80,000 a year when you get out?
Well, it kind of depends on where you go when you start. Starting salary could be anything from $65,000 to $75,000.
Great. Okay. Well, first of all, I firmly encourage you. Is this something you enjoy, or are you doing it for the money?
Oh, I completely enjoy it. This is something that I've been working towards for a long time.
Fantastic. First of all, I applaud you for going to school to get this degree. Highly unlikely that this job will go away anytime soon. And second of all, you are actually right to borrow the money to do this. And even to the point of not using up your $3,000 in savings, one of the things about borrowing money to go to school, especially for a degree or training that is really applicable in the workforce, is that you can safely pay that loan off in 10 years, that $80,000 even, let's say, by paying 1% of the original balance per month. And that's a rule of thumb, of course, that assumes that you're going to have interest rates in the single digits. But $80,000 in student loans means you can pay it off in $800 payments every month for 10 years. And that sounds like a lot of money. My cable bill isn't even that high. But if you pay off $800 per month on $80,000, that's about, you know, $10,000 a year or so. That still nets you out $70,000 a year before taxes and housing and everything like that. But if you said, hey, I'm still going to have $70,000 a year after I make these loan payments, that's a great deal. Any business person would be glad to take that proposition. So do it, but don't use your $3,000 to worry about the debt or the interest. Just use that to cover other savings, like, you know, to fix your car so you can get to school, or to pay for trips if you need to go on a job interview or something, or some kind of conference for education. Use that savings so that you can cover your unexpected expenses like your dog or your check engine light, and then slowly pay the loans off once you actually get out of school, get a degree, and get a job.
Sound good, Maria? Oh, I guess we lost Maria. Sounded good to me, Kevin.
Well, don't leave yet, Joy. Finish the show before you go back to school, okay?
Well, Stephanie emailed us, Kevin, and she says, I have gone back to work after 5 months of having my first child. My current work does not offer any retirement savings, and I do not have anything started. Do you suggest I start a Roth IRA, or what do you suggest?
Back up a second here. Labor is now 5 months.
Well,
I think my three kids, the longest we went was maybe 18 hours.
Wait a minute. Did I say labor? I meant after 5 months of her maternity leave, she went back.
Oh, maternity leave. Okay. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I said having her first child, and I thought, gosh, I said, I don't keep up on this like I used to.
That would be a long one.
That actually allows us a brief anecdote here. When I was taking the parenting classes, when my wife Rachel and I had our first child, before we had the first child, the instructor separated the women into one side and the men in the other. And she said, I want you all to just talk about the concerns you have about childbirth and labor and everything, and what you're worried about. Talk with each other and then get back to us. Write them down, and then we'll compare notes. And so the guys got over. And of course, we don't want to be there. There was a basketball game on, but we know that we're supposed to do that. So we sit down, and it's just quiet, and everybody's kind of hemming and hawing. And one guy says, well, I have a little concern about this. And we said, okay, what is it? He said, well, I heard that this labor can take like 18 to 24 hours or longer. And we said, yeah, I think that's right. Why? And he said, well, I'm worried about getting bored.
Oh, God. Is he is he still married, by the way?
We said, does anyone else have that concern? They went, no, just what's your name, Steve? Okay, Steve is worried about getting bored. Okay, anybody else? So, Stephanie's on the right track here. She should open a Roth IRA. Roth IRAs are good for just about anyone who qualifies to open one. You have to have earnings, or you have to be married to someone who has earnings, but the earnings can't be too much, generally about $160,000 per year if you're married filing jointly, and about $100,000 or so for single filers. The key point, as we mentioned before, is that contributions can be withdrawn at any time for any reason whatsoever with no taxes or penalties. And the good people at the IRS let you designate all of your withdrawals as contributions until you've used up the amount of money you've put into the Roth IRA. So rather than looking at it as a retirement account that is gone for 30 years, Stephanie should look at this as a savings account that just happens to be in a Roth IRA so that the earnings are sheltered from taxation and she can pull it out tax-free in retirement.
Mm-hmm. Is there a type of investment you would recommend she consider?
If she is really using this as an ersatz savings account and might need the money in 6 months or a year, she really has to keep it safe, especially if she can't stomach any kind of loss whatsoever. So CDs, money markets, maybe some very conservative mutual funds like bond funds, but even those can drop in dire times. She might be better off if she's looking at this as a long-term investment of going with a target date fund, and you can set the fund's target date so that it hopefully matches up with specific timing of goals that she might be planning on using the money in.
Yeah, I remember us talking about the target date fund before. How does that work?
Well, they're not perfect, and there's not something that you just have to put the money in and just ignore forever, but it's generally a mix of stock and bond and money market mutual funds that start out more aggressive, in meaning there's more money in the stocks, and then almost on autopilot, they kind of correct and become more conservative as the target date approaches. So say you had something happening in 2040, you're going to retire, or you're going to send a child or grandchild to college. If you put the money in now, you'd have more stocks than bonds and money market accounts. But as time went on and the 2040 date neared, it would become more conservative and get more income and more money market funds.
And then how would you make deposits?
Well, in any type of account, whether it's a money market or a target date or anything of the Roth IRA, you have to put the money in usually by April 15th of the next tax year. So people can still make a contribution for their 2010 tax year into a Roth IRA. The limits are generally $5,000 or earned income, whichever is less. But a nicer way to do this, especially for people say, I need to do something with this money to save it, but I can't come up with $5,000 on a moment's notice. You can set up auto deposits where anywhere from $25 up to $400 a month can automatically be taken from your checking account and be deposited into the Roth IRA. And you can stop it, you can restart it, do that whenever you want. But usually when it's done on a smaller, regular basis like that, you won't miss it as much. And you also won't have to remember to make the deposit.
Thanks to Stephanie for that email, and hope all is going well with her. If you would like to send an email, if we don't get to it today, perhaps at a future program, send it to onyourmoney@wpr.org. You can also call 1-800-642-1234. I'm Joy Cardine, along with Kevin McKinley, Certified Financial Planner and Managing Member of McKinley Money, LLC. This is On Your Money on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. And this is another All Questions Answered edition of On Your Money. I'm Joy Cardine, along with Kevin McKinley, and our next caller is Jeff in Iron County. Hello, Jeff.
Hello. My question is, can you hear me?
Yes, go ahead, please.
Oh, my question is, a friend just called me last night, and she worked at a clothing store that has now gone out of business, and they gave her two checks for totaling about $30,000. Her first question is, she was told by another friend that if she cashed those, she'd be paying taxes on them. So she'd, well, and this money was from a 401k that cashed out for whatever reason. So her first question is, should she not cash those? In other words, put them in her checking account or a savings account, because then she would be required by the IRA to pay taxes. And she's about 6 years from retirement, around 62, when she wants to, in 6 years, she'll be 62 when she wants to use the money. What would you recommend she did with the money? Is there a way to roll it over into something, even though she's at this point has the checks in her hand?
You are a good friend, Jeff, and mm-hmm. you are right to call on your friend's behalf on this matter, because there is a danger that if she were to cash the checks and they originated from where you believe they came from, that she would not only pay taxes on it in at a bad time to do it probably, but she may lose up to 10% of that value as a penalty as well. What I would have her do is check to see how the checks are made out. Hopefully they are just made out to her account as a trustee for her to a custodian. Usually, if that's the case, she can hold it, and she may be able to transfer it into a new IRA at a bank or credit union or financial services company, insurance company, mutual fund, whatever, millions of places she can go with that. But in terms of the check is just made out to her, there is a danger with that, and it may not have come from a retirement plan. It may just be some kind of payout, because usually people have to sign for distribution from a custodian to get the checks out of the payout plan. Was this a very small store, Jeff, or was it a large chain?
It was. They had two stores, so I would say, it was in Iowa, so small scale probably.
Okay. What I would have her do is, if she has some HR person whom she can contact, is do not cash the checks under any circumstances, at least right now. Now, she may need that money to live on at some point, but she definitely wants to roll it over into an IRA if she possibly can, and if indeed it did come from an actual pre-tax retirement plan. There's, from the information and the situation, it sounds a little dodgy, and you're not quite sure where that money came from. But if it did come from a pre-tax retirement plan, she definitely wants to, she not only can roll it over as long as she doesn't cash it, but she should roll it over at least until she needs the money. And I'm sorry, you said she wants to retire at 62 in about 6 years or so?
Right. Yeah, she wants to use the money then, and it came from a 401k plan.
Okay. Then she should be very cautious about what she does with it and try to get the check back to the custodian so that the custodian can move it over to a new place. If she has a bank or credit union she uses, it's almost guaranteed they offer IRAs. And so she can take that check into the bank or credit union and ask them if it's possible to just take this check and put it into an IRA on her behalf, and that at least gets it over to a self-directed account so that she can decide what to do with it later on. I'd keep it relatively conservative, though. A six-year time frame isn't really that much, especially in these times and when she won't have a job. So I would she might want to leave it in the bank or credit union for the foreseeable future, but especially get it over there now so that they can handle the money properly. But do not deposit it in anything other than an actual IRA. Don't tell her not to put it in an actual checking account that she can draw from whenever she wants.
Got it. Thank you.
Thank you, Jeff. And you are a good friend. Thanks for calling. Mary in Wisconsin Rapids. Hi, Mary. You're on the air.
Yes, I am.
Yes, go ahead with your question, please.
Okay. I do have a stockbroker, and about a year ago he told me that not to worry about things, that he would be my financial planner. My question is, what is a certified financial planner? I do not know whether he is or not, compared to a stockbroker. That's my first question. And the second is, how can I check to his credentials? And three, can I ask him for references? And fourth, I found a website about financial planners, but in order to enroll, you had to give a range of the amount of money you had, and I did not want to do that on the web.
Do you have a fifth question, Mary? I'm just kidding. lots of good questions.
These are excellent questions, and especially right now, a lot of people are asking these, and it is going to be something that's going to get more attention over the next few months as the regulators decide or try to figure out how to determine what people who offer financial advice are called and how they should be regulated. And if they should be regulated any differently. Well, first of all, let's ask you a question. Your stockbroker, that's what people used to be called in the 60s, 70s, and 80s. And very few people are actually just stockbrokers right now. Most of them handle lots of other financial issues along with buying and selling stocks. And in fact, most of them, to my knowledge, don't even buy and sell stocks very much anymore for people. It's more about mutual funds, tax planning, loans, insurance, et cetera. Second thing is about just about anyone can call themselves a financial planner. In terms of getting a CFP, I'm a CFP. It means that you've basically passed a pretty strict course and regimen and test to earn the designation. And then you have to keep it up with continuing education, and you also have to adhere to ethical standards that the CFP monitors for how you treat people. If you have any customer complaints or whatever, you're in danger of losing that designation for it. CFPs, just that's what it means for better or for worse. It means they've passed a test. It doesn't mean that they're better or worse. It just means that they've passed the test, and hopefully an independent body has verified that they have some training and some professional background for it. In terms of finding someone who does this kind of thing and references, the references are always a little tricky, and the reason being is that especially for those of us in Wisconsin, we generally don't like talking about money with our own family members, much less complete strangers. And so it's hard to find someone who is willing to vouch for an advisor's services. The second thing about it is that person's needs and goals might be completely different from yours, Mary. So even if that person is happy, you may not be, or if that person's dissatisfied. The third thing is references are not as useful as we might imagine, because if you call anybody up, whether it's your plumber or whomever, they're not going to give you their dissatisfied customers to talk to. They're going to give you the three happiest mm-hmm. people, and it's probably going to be a relative or a near relative. And finally, even if that person is an independent customer and willing to vouch for this advisor services, that was then. This is now. The forward thinking customer might not be as happy as what was happened. So references generally aren't as useful as you might think. What I would rather have you do is go to a CPA or some type of tax person, see if he or she knows anybody who can who they can recommend for it that meets your specific needs, and then ask questions about how do you get paid, what do you specialize in, and why won't I like you? We all have great brochures and websites that tell us how great we are. But a better question to say, what would people say if I asked every one of your clients anonymously, what would they say they really don't like about you? And that's a more revealing question and answer than why are you so great and why should I give you my money?
Does that make sense, Mary?
Oh, that helps a great deal because, there's so much to consider. And, I want to be an active member in, active partner in managing my money. And so I'm rather new at this, and I have to know what I'm doing.
Thank you very much. Step number one here. Does it say CFP after someone's name typically, Kevin, if that's what they are?
Yeah, yes, it does. Mm-hmm. And you can go to, I think it's CFP.org or CFPboard.org or something if you want to search for a certified financial planner. And again, there are lots of good advisors who are not CFPs. Mm-hmm. And just because you have a CFP doesn't mean you have a good advisor. It just means they're someone who hopefully is focused a little more on financial planning than, say, buying and selling stocks or gold coins or something like that.
And now we go to a question from Lori, who says she enjoys our show on Wisconsin Public Radio every Tuesday. So she got that false praise in right away.
Good, I appreciate that. And just every Tuesday. If you ask her on Wednesday, so do you like on Money Money? Not really. If you ask her on Thursday, no.
Yeah, she just likes it when, if you ask her on Tuesday, yes.
Yeah, Tuesday I enjoy it.
Well, anyway, Lori and her husband deposited about $14,000 into an annuity that was part of a 403B retirement savings plan. The surrender charge has expired, and they want to close out the annuity that's now worth about $18,000. The question is, how can they do this without paying a lot in taxes, and should they convert it to a Roth IRA?
Well, actually, they probably should take it out of the annuity if they're not happy with it and they have a better alternative, and they can roll it over into a self-directed IRA, again, at a bank or a credit union or a mutual fund company or a financial services company. And as long as it is a custodian-to-custodian transfer, meaning they don't take possession of the cash and spend it, there should be no taxes on it whatsoever.
So should it be a Roth IRA versus a traditional one?
It can be, and it perhaps should be, as long as their income after they convert this money to a Roth IRA still remains below the 25% federal tax bracket. That's line 43 on the 1040 form for 2011. The difference between the 15% federal bracket and the 25% bracket is at about $69,000 on line 43 for married couples filing jointly and half that for single people. And where someone who's kind of in between work and taking Social Security should really want to take a strong look at doing this and making this conversion is if they can stay below that 25% limit, and then also before they take Social Security. And the reason being is that Roth IRA distributions don't make Social Security taxable, but distributions from a regular IRA do. So it's a good idea for them to look at it.
What about people who have annuities that are not a part of a retirement plan but want to take the money out?
We see this a lot with new clients of ours. They may owe taxes on the money when they pull it out, but it's only on the appreciated portion of that annuity. Meaning if they put $10,000 in and it's now worth $15,000 and they pull the money out, they would only owe taxes on the $5,000 portion, and that is taxed at income, which will be at their highest rate, but it's only on the earnings portion of the annuity. If they don't have a gain or they don't have much of a gain, there will be no extra taxes on that distribution, and it's a little tricky, but if they have a loss in the annuity, they may even be able to deduct that loss against their other income.
And there's no way around paying taxes if there was a gain?
If there's a gain on a non-qualified annuity, meaning money you just put into it wasn't part of your at-work retirement plan, there are a couple of ways to mitigate the taxes. First of all, you want to take the distribution in a year where you have either low income or larger deductions because of donations or because of maybe some losses you have. A better way to do it is if you're working and you're not maxing out your pre-tax retirement plan, pull the money out of the annuity, and then whatever the taxable amount is, use that amount to make a contribution to a pre-tax retirement plan, like an IRA or 403B or a 401K. And by doing that, you'll offset the amount of income coming from the annuity. At least gives you a chance to get the money out. Yes, you're kicking the can down the road, but hopefully your tax bracket in retirement will be lower, and therefore you'll avoid paying a lot in taxes between working and retiring.
This week on Your Money, certified financial planner Kevin McKinley is answering your personal finance questions. And we will get to more of your calls in just a moment at 1-800-642-1234, or you can send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. This is On Your Money on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
There is nothing quite as wonderful as money. There is nothing quite as beautiful as cash. Some people say it's folly, but I'd rather have the lolly. With money you can make a splash.
You're listening to On Your Money on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine along with Kevin McKinley. And a listener named Jean or Jeannie wants to make sure that when we discuss ways to save money at the supermarket, as we did a week or two ago, that we don't forget to mention Aldi stores. Kevin, are you a fan of Aldi stores?
I'm aware of their existence, yes. Mm-hmm. They and others like them are definitely worth discussing in these times of rapidly rising food prices. Aldi stores were founded in 1946 in Germany, and then in 1976 they came to the States with a store in Batavia, Illinois. There are about 8,500 Aldi stores worldwide, about 1,400 in the U.S., and a little over 60 in Wisconsin. They're basically mini warehouse stores. They're very small. They're kind of, they look very, the logo's very 70s, but I think that's part of the charm for the customers. They charge for bags. They charge for carts. There's no phone number in stores, and the reason they say they do that is because they don't want to pay employees to answer the phone. They want them to serve the customers who are in the store already. They only take cash or electronic debit card or EBT payments. They don't take credit cards, and they have a double price guarantee, meaning if you're not satisfied with any of your products, you bring it back and they'll refund double the price you paid for it. That does not apply to liquor. And I just wondered about the people who, you know, got all the way through 4/5 the way through of a fifth and said, this didn't
satisfied.
Work. I'm not satisfied. Where's the manager?
You know, that's quite the guarantee, though, Kevin. Gosh,
it is. You don't see that very often anymore, do you?
Yeah, you know, not at all. So what are some of the other non-traditional places to get groceries?
Well, there are a lot to choose from. Super Target, of course, are predominant in the Wisconsin area. Walmart and Sam's Club obviously carry groceries and try to keep prices as low as possible. We've got a couple Costco's, but not as many as in many other states. And for people who enjoy this type of shopping and really have the time and the energy to look, farmers markets and co-ops are always a good place to go as well. And because this is such a competitive time for pricing, people are paying much more attention to what they pay for groceries. Many stores and places are using individual items as loss leaders. So there are, you know, you can basically, if you visit enough stores, you can fill up your grocery cart and fill out your list and still save a lot of money.
Oh, well, I guess I got to worry about those gas prices a little bit, but no.
That's right.
What is the best way? How do you keep up with all the deals at all the different stores?
Well, if you really find yourself wanting to cut back, and the American household right now, I think, spends something like $8,500 to $9,000 a year on average at the grocery store. That works out to about $150 to $180 per week. So it's a huge portion of Americans' budgets right now, and it's only going to go up likely in the next few months. It does come down to time versus money. Like you said, chasing around, you know, trying to save 10 cents on a gallon of milk and burning up a buck's worth of gas is probably not the best idea. A couple simple ways to do this, though. First one, get the local newspaper. You know, they sure could use your subscription, but they also serve as a vehicle to get those ads there. And you may not want all the ads, but the supermarkets still advertise very heavily, and especially inserts, and especially in the Sunday paper of the local newspaper. Second of all, go to all the different stores in your area and get on their email list, because many times they'll email those mailers to you on a more environmentally friendly manner and a more timely manner. Then you set up a grid. On a piece of paper where your shopping list, you put your items on the left-hand side and then the stores across the top. And then check, put an X or a check in each box underneath each store of where you want to get that item, where you see it, and even write the price in the box so you can compare that. And then when someone's going to one store, they'll have all the items that they need to get at that particular store at the best possible price. And it does mean that you kind of have to plan your shopping out, plan your menus out better, and keep things on hand more than you otherwise would. But again, if you can save even 10%, that's $75 to $100 per month that you can cut out of your expenses.
And since we're on the subject of supermarkets right now, do you have a good buy for us this week?
Well, we've discussed soda before, and a couple of callers weighed in several months ago about looking for Mexican Coke, as they called it, which by the way, just as a heads up to listeners, don't drive down to Mexico, and then when you get to the border, when they say, you know, why are you going in the country, don't say, I'm looking for Mexican Coke.
That would not be a good idea.
Right. No. And even if you do get it and you're coming back and you get to, you know, Texas or whatever, they say, what, you know, do you have anything to declare? And say, well, I just have a trunk full of Mexican Coke. That's
not a good idea
at all. It just leads to way more headache than you could possibly imagine. But the reason they're looking for Mexican Coke is because it has supposedly real sugar rather than the high fructose corn syrup. Pepsi has adopted this. Sometimes they have throwback versions of the Pepsi soda and Mountain Dew. But Sierra Mist Natural now is a regular product. It's like Sprite or 7-Up, a distant third in market share. But they now have no high fructose corn syrup. And a listener said, you know, if you like supposed real sugar in your soda, Sierra Mist Natural is one you can usually pick up and at a relatively low price.
Well, let's take calls for the rest of the hour. And Mary in Milwaukee is with us. Hello, Mary.
Hi, I'm another fan of this good financial advice. Mine is on credit, line of credit. And I'd like to know, should one shop for the best place based on interest rate and whatever fee they would have? I'd also like to know what's involved in a bank extending that line. And lastly, do credit unions extend credit lines?
Those are good questions, mm-hmm. And you can shop for it. Generally, it's a commodity, but depending on especially when it comes to home equity lines of credit, because when it comes to a mortgage, banks and credit unions generally are going to resell that mortgage down the road, and it's going to be ostensibly guaranteed by some governmental ostensible government agency. So that's actually more of a commodity. The home equity lines of credit are usually kept at the credit union or bank, and so there might be more differences. So yes, you definitely should shop for it and take a look around in your area. Start with your own institutions, but this might be a good time, with the changes going on, to look down the street and see if there is a bank or credit union that might offer you more favorable terms. And it usually will come to the amount that they'll offer, the terms of the interest rate, and then also the fees. If you haven't had an appraisal in a year or two, you're generally going to have a new appraisal, and you'll probably have to pay for that, but that's a few hundred dollars or so. In terms of credit unions, yes, I definitely would. Credit unions in general have not had some of the problems that some of the larger banks have had, and have some opportunities available for people that they can't get anymore at other places. So you have to shop around for your financial services just in the same way that you'd shop for a car or bananas.
Thank you, Mary. Dennis in Oshkosh is with us. Hello, Dennis.
Good morning. Kevin, I have a question about, the question comes from your brochure on Social Security. My question is, I've been on Social Security about a year, and what I got from the brochure is it might be worth my while to stop mine, my wife who's 62, to start hers. And then it was my understanding that she then collects half of mine. I don't know if I have that accurate or not, but that's my question.
Does that sound about right, Kevin?
Sounds like something I'd say. Dennis, you're referring, of course, to the On Your Money, Many Money book that,
yes, sir.
That was one of the pledge premiums of the last time
yep.
out. Have you checked with the good people at Social Security to see what the dollar amount difference would be?
Well, I'm talking to them on the 31st, so yes, 31st I will be checking, but I
March.
Have not yet.
Okay. You're asking this, Dennis, of course, just to say, hey, Kevin, how can we get as much money as possible over our natural lives from Social Security, correct?
Yep.
Okay. Normally, I would say waiting is always best, especially if you plan on living to at least 79 or 80. That's usually the break-even age.
Yeah, and I think so mine's 81, but
yours is 81. Okay, and that's how long you plan on living, too?
Well, I was going for another day or two.
If you look at it in that way, yes, you should wait and you should delay all the benefits that you possibly can, and even if it means accepting a lower check on a spousal benefit. Generally, Social Security recipients, though, in times of very low interest rates and very high risk in the stock market compared to other times in our lives, you should get as much out of Social Security as you can today and not worry about 78 and 79 and 80, in part because we're not sure you or I will be around at that time. Second of all, it means that you get that money to spend right now and you can keep your savings. Would the checks be lower if you were to do what you were doing, Dennis, versus what you've done already?
Well, my guess is, yes. My wife had very little income. You know, in round figures, I'm getting about $1,500. She would, if I started hers or she started hers, she'd be getting about $500.
Okay.
So, but then my understanding is she'd get like $750, which is half of mine, and then mine would build over the years, but obviously then hers wouldn't build. So
that's right. Yeah, usually the choice is to get either the higher of the spousal option or the actual the earned option once you finally get all the way through it. But I would definitely tell you, so you're saying you're going to delay yours, if I understand that correctly?
Well, I would stop it. I do the repay thing because I've only been on it for about 8 months.
Okay, yeah, that window, of course, as you know, is closing much faster than once had. Yep.
Yeah.
I would still say this to Dennis. $1,500 a month is $18,000 a year. At 3% interest, you would need $600,000 kicking off an interest check to replace that. And unless you have several $100,000 or even $1 million in savings, I would much rather have you stay on that check, keep getting it, and be able to keep whatever you do have in savings intact rather than drawing it down to nothing and hoping that there's a higher benefit down the road.
Well, I hope, Dennis, that works for you. Thank you so much for the call. And I wish we had time for the callers who are waiting. My apologies, but there's always next week.
We'll do more of this next week.
Yeah, we have time, though, for the website of the week, Kevin.
Well, we mentioned all the different places from which you can shop for food. We would be remiss to forget about one of our favorite sites, localharvest.org. It has over 25,000 listings nationwide of farms, community-supported agriculture, entities, restaurants, groceries, co-ops, food co-ops, and that's 1,000 in Wisconsin alone. localharvest.org, and we'll have that website up at our website, onyourmoney.com, later on today.
And time enough for four more words before we go.
Spend less, have more.
Kevin McKinley is a certified financial planner, managing member of McKinley Money LLC, with offices in Eau Claire and Madison. And he will be back with us next week for another edition of On Your Money. If you didn't get your question in this week, you can always send an email, onyourmoney@wpr.org. And perhaps we will get to it on a future program. Thanks to Rob Ferret and to Bill Martins for producing this hour. Thank you for listening. Hope you stay tuned. There's much more to come. And I hope you join us tomorrow at this time when we talk about self-control. Why do we have such a hard time resisting what's bad for us and doing what's good for us? That's tomorrow at this time. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network.